The vast majority of Afghans who have come here are just good, upstanding citizens.
What we know about the alleged suspect who shot two members of the National Guard in Washington, D.C. For Thursday, November 27th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Happy Thanksgiving. Pope Leo is in Turkey. It's his first international trip as the head of the Roman Catholic Church. We will hear from our correspondent traveling with him.
Society is alive if it has a plurality. For what makes it a civil society are the bridges that link its people together.
And this fall saw an intense focus on food insecurity, but what about food waste?
If food waste were its own country, then it would be the third largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world.
Plus, how Wicked may jolt the holiday box office. Those stories and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News, I'm Dale Willman. The two National Guard members shot yesterday in Washington, D.C. have been identified as 24-year-old Andrew Wolf and 20-year-old Sarah Beckstrom. Both underwent surgery and remain in critical condition, according to authorities. NPR's Juliana Kim reports.
The West Virginia National Guard says Sarah Beckstrom is an Army specialist who joined the service in 2023. Andrew Wolf is an Air Force staff sergeant who entered the service in 2019. Beckstrom is from Somersville in central West Virginia, while Wolf is from Martinsburg, which is in the state's eastern panhandle and less than a two-hour drive to Washington, D.C. and Baltimore. Both Beckstrom and Wolf had been deployed to D.C. since August when the troop deployment in the city began. Authorities have described the shooting as a targeted attack, and it's being investigated as an act of terrorism. Juliana Kim, NPR News.
At least 65 people are dead and hundreds are missing after a fire broke out at a massive housing complex in Hong Kong on Wednesday. Cherise Pham has more.
Firefighters are going through the wreckage of apartment buildings floor by floor, searching for survivors. The fire department said they rescued an elderly man from the 31st floor of one of the buildings on Thursday afternoon. Later in the evening, more than 24 hours after the fire started, they found another survivor in a staircase, according to local media reports. The public housing complex where the fire broke out is home to about 4,600 people. The high-rise apartment towers had been under renovation and covered in bamboo scaffolding, which caught fire and collapsed. Police said the construction material found around the buildings did not meet safety standards and may have been the reason the fire spread so quickly. Three people from the company responsible for the renovations have been arrested on suspected manslaughter charges. For NPR News, I'm Cherise Pham in Hong Kong.
The National Retail Federation says holiday sales will likely surpass $1 trillion for the first time this year. If their prediction holds, it would mean a 3.7 to 4.2% sales increase over 2024. Federation Chief Economist Mark Matthews says the increase would in part be due to President Trump's tariffs, but he also says Americans are in a spending mood and they're shopping even earlier.
What we've seen over time is, you know, this weekend, in a shopping context, used to be about, you know, in-store on Black Friday. That's changed, right? People are shopping earlier than before, and they're shopping across the holiday weekend, not just in-store, but online.
Videos being shown on TV stations in the Middle East right now appear to show Israeli soldiers killing two Palestinian men in the occupied West Bank after they had already surrendered. Palestinian officials say the men were murdered in cold blood. Israel's military says it's investigating the claim, and it says the two were wanted militants who had thrown explosives at troops. You're listening to NPR News. For many Americans, it's an unspoken rule to avoid political discussions at the Thanksgiving dinner table. And as NPR's Elena Moore reports, the latest NPR PBS News Marist poll may help explain why. It finds that both Democrats and Republicans are skeptical of people who are in the other party.
Vast majorities of both Democrats and Republicans say that folks who support the other party are, quote, mostly close-minded. Plus, 72% of Republicans and 65% of Democrats believe those on the other side of the aisle are, quote, mostly dishonest. For some, like Democratic voter Teresa Tucker in Michigan, engaging in political discussions has become difficult.
I think it's definitely gotten worse. I think, unfortunately, this administration has pitted people against each other. And, you know, if we would have more conversations, I think we would find we have a lot more in common than we don't.
She says this holiday season, the focus at her dinner won't be on politics. It'll be on family and festivities. Elena Moore, NPR News.
A new joint U.S.-Russian crew has reached the International Space Station. The team lifted off this afternoon from Kazakhstan and docked with the station several hours later. The three are expected to stay at the space station for 8 months. They're joining seven other astronauts already in space, including three from the U.S., three from Russia, and one from Japan. Pope Leo XIV is in Turkey today, where he said that country could become a source of stability and dialogue in a world torn by conflict. And he praised the country's historic role of being what he called a bridge between the West and the East. The Pope also offered a message of peace. It was his first international trip as Pope. I'm Dale Willman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org. This is NPR.
It is 6 minutes past the hour, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for KAXE comes from Timberlake Restaurant, offering fresh baked popovers, crafted cocktails, and menu items such as walleye a la Ritz or chicken Kiev. Information about the dinner menu is available at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. And coming up at 5:30, it's going to be the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. Happy Thanksgiving. I'm Scott Detrow. We know more today about the man accused of shooting two members of the National Guard in downtown Washington, D.C. His name is Rakhmanullah Lakhanwal. He's 29, he is Afghan, and he worked with U.S. forces, including the CIA, in Afghanistan before coming to the U.S. Federal officials say part of the international terror investigation, that's how they're framing it, now underway, will focus on that history. Trump administration officials are also claiming that Lakhanwal was not properly vetted before entering the U.S. And NPR's Brian Mann is following developments. Hi, Brian.
Hi there, Scott.
Let's start with the two National Guard soldiers injured in this attack. How are they doing?
Federal officials are telling us that 20-year-old Sarah Beckstrom and 24-year-old Andrew Wolf have undergone surgery. They remain in critical condition. Family members from West Virginia are with them at the hospital. The U.S. Attorney for Washington, D.C., Jeanine Pirro, spoke at a press conference this morning.
Two families are shattered and destroyed and torn apart as a result of the actions of one man.
Now, Scott, Washington, D.C.'s Mayor Muriel Bowser also spoke today. She's been a critic of this National Guard deployment in her city, but she described yesterday's shooting as an attack on America. And referring to these wounded soldiers, Bowser said these young people should be at home with their families in West Virginia.
We are learning more about the alleged shooter. What do we know about his background and possible motive?
Yeah, officials say Lakhanwal allegedly drove across the United States from his home in Washington State to carry out what's being called a targeted attack. He used a handgun. Pirro said he'll be charged with terrorism and she will seek the death penalty if either soldier dies. She said it's too early, Scott, to say what the motive might have been here. Officials have confirmed Lakhanwal worked closely with the U.S. military in Afghanistan. A nonprofit group called Afghan Evac says he was part of an elite counterterrorism unit. And FBI Director Kash Patel said today that part of Lakhanwal's history will be a major focus of this investigation that's now underway.
We are fully investigating that aspect of his background as well, to include any known associates that are either overseas or here in the United States of America.
Now, during that press conference, Patel also said Lakhanwal was not properly vetted before entering the U.S. He blamed the Biden administration, saying Biden's team failed, and I'm quoting here, failed to vet in any way, shape, or form this individual and countless others.
Brian, what do we know about that vetting process, though?
Yeah, what NPR has been able to learn so far is that it appears Lakhanwal would have been vetted by the CIA and other U.S. forces inside Afghanistan. There was also a process for scrutinizing Afghan nationals who entered the U.S. after the U.S. withdrawal and the Taliban takeover. There were audits, including one conducted by the FBI this year, that did find flaws with this process. It wasn't perfect, but these refugees were definitely vetted. The FBI's report released in June described their role in the process as effective and appropriate. Lakhanwal entered the U.S. in 2021 and was just granted asylum status in April of this year under the Trump administration. Given all that, Sean Vandiver, who's a Navy veteran, he leads the group Afghan Evac, who helps refugees. He says he's skeptical of this Trump administration statement that Lakhanwal wasn't properly vetted.
Correct. We don't know yet. And look,
if there was a vetting failure, then we got to fix it. But you can't paint with a broad brush this entire community, right? The vast majority of Afghans who have come here are just good, upstanding citizens.
But for now, Scott, the Trump administration is making this immigration issue a major focus. They've suspended all refugee and asylum applications for Afghan nationals. That could affect tens of thousands of people. Officials also say Afghan nationals who entered the U.S. under the Biden-era refugee program, they're now going to face additional scrutiny.
That is NPR's Brian Mann. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Scott.
Nobody loves both sweating and having chills, so if you come down with a fever, you might reach for the Tylenol right away. But right in time for cold and flu season, new research suggests there could be a reason for all that heat. NPR's Jonathan Lambert reports.
The notion that fever can be a good thing is a very old idea. In the 5th century, the Greek physician Hippocrates thought that fever could cook an illness out of a patient. Sam Wilson is a microbiologist at the University of Cambridge. He says that the idea has stuck around.
This kind of a cultural knowledge, this relationship between temperature and viruses.
Scientific knowledge has caught up recently, with many studies suggesting that fevers help fight infections across all kinds of animals. But there's still a big unresolved question. What are fevers actually doing? Are they literally cooking viruses? Or are feverish temperatures just some regrettable but unavoidable byproduct of ramping up the immune system?
The fact that there weren't definitive answers to these questions kind of piqued my interest.
To study it, Wilson and his colleagues turned to bird flu. Influenza A viruses that infect birds target their gut, which is a few degrees warmer than the airways favored by human influenza.
So this means that bird flus are adapted to replicate at a higher temperature, a temperature equivalent to that of a human fever.
The researchers pinpointed a part of the bird flu genome that helps the virus thrive in that warm environment, and they inserted this heat-tolerant snippet into a human virus. This gave them two nearly identical versions of influenza, a normal human one and a heat-tolerant one. To isolate the impact of heat alone on infection, mice turned out to be really useful.
It just so happens that mice don't mount their own fever to an influenza A virus infection.
Under normal lab conditions, mice infected with both strains got sick. But when the researchers turned up the heat to simulate a fever, they found a key difference. Mice that got the normal virus fared well, suggesting the heat in and of itself helped fight the infection. But the mice with a heat-resistant strain still got sick.
It's a brilliant paper. I think it's definitely adds to our knowledge of how fever has an effect. The idea being that higher temperatures interfere with the viral replication of influenza.
Joe Alcock is an emergency physician and researcher at the University of New Mexico. He says there are some caveats. While the study clearly shows temperature makes a difference, it doesn't rule out the idea that fever helps ramp up other immune responses too. It also doesn't mean that fever works precisely the same way for humans.
It is a mouse study.
But to Alcock, the results, published in the journal Science, add to the growing body of evidence that fever evolved for a reason, and that physicians like him might be too quick to treat it.
We treat fevers almost like a knee-jerk reaction, giving medicines like acetaminophen or Tylenol.
Those kinds of medicines are, of course, important, since fever can be dangerous for humans, too. But Alcock thinks the study raises a question.
When we are reaching for the bottle of Tylenol or ibuprofen when we have a cold that's caused by a virus, is it possible that I might be actually making it tougher for my body to get rid of the infection?
As of now, that's still an unanswered question. But this study suggests that it's one that researchers should consider. Jonathan Lambert, NPR News.
Today, millions of Americans are enjoying a whole lot of food, but Thanksgiving can also mean a lot of food waste, which is a major contributor to climate change. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz visited one facility in New York that is trying to address the issue in a sustainable way.
In the days leading up to Thanksgiving, people rush to get what they need for their holiday feasts. But while the holiday season means meals with loved ones, it could also mean lots of food waste.
You want to give people all sorts of options to eat. And I think this behavioral tendency to cook more than we truly need is also part of Thanksgiving.
Ted Janicki is a professor at Penn State who studies food waste. And he says what we throw out has big implications.
Around the globe, if food waste were its own country, then it would be the third largest greenhouse gas emitter in the world.
That's because food in landfills piles up breaks down and produces methane, a greenhouse gas.
And methane is a far more potent greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide.
And that's of particular concern around the holidays. The Natural Resources Defense Council, an environmental advocacy group, says Thanksgiving is the biggest day for food waste in the U.S. But the Staten Island compost facility is handling this problem on a massive scale. Back in the spring, New York City made composting mandatory for residents.
How would you describe the composting process?
It's basically a bunch of tiny microorganisms, invertebrates, bacteria that are converting the organic material.
Jennifer McDonald is the Deputy Commissioner for Solid Waste Management at the New York City Department of Sanitation.
So they're metabolizing, they're growing, dying, eating, excreting, and that's really the active biological conversion process. And what it does is it's stable.
Letting food break down in this way produces fewer carbon emissions. And there's reason to believe it's better for local communities, too.
And for other facilities like incinerators, there are concerns about the impacts from air emissions, even landfill concerns about air emissions on local communities.
Despite the benefits, municipal compost sites like this are not the norm, according to Janicki, the food waste scholar.
I wish there was a coordinated effort, but it's a total patchwork of city, state, and private sector.
It's really hard for cities to implement compost programs. One major challenge is infrastructure, having the space and equipment to do this work. Another challenge is education. McDonald says it's taken a lot of work to get participation in New York's program to close to 10%.
It takes about 10 years to mature to get to a participation rate. It really is about behavior change, right?
And that's tough.
The larger nugget, perhaps, is, again, getting people comfortable with separating food waste, right? Like, how do I do that in my kitchen? When do I take it out to the collection point?
She says it's about changing minds and behavior.
In our culture, where we produce so much waste from just existing, we have to be thoughtful about how to have a long-term, sustainable approach to properly managing all those things.
It's a lot of work, but she says well worth the effort. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
NPR's Alana Wise contributed to this reporting. You can find photos from their visit to the Staten Island compost facility at npr.org. Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is The Set List on KAXC, where we highlight live music around the area for the upcoming week. I'm Malachi Coons. We are taking a look at four shows this Friday and Saturday, November 28th and 29th in Grand Rapids and La Porte. First up, Doyle Turner and Sarah Morris are playing at the Popple Bar in La Porte Friday at 6 p.m. The pair collaborated on Turner's latest Paper Maps release, and Morris just put out a new album called Say Yes in October. Both are talented songwriters and singers who blend jazz, pop, and Americana. Friday in La Porte at the Popple Bar. Next up, a pair of Mankato songwriters are playing at Rapids Brewing Friday night at 6. Nate Boots is an Americana and folk musician who has led bands like The High Horses and Porchlights. He just released a solo album called A Stretch of a Wing, A Leap. Murphy is an up-and-coming folk rocker who recently released a great new single called Sugar. Nate Boots and Mal Murphy in Grand Rapids this Friday. It's a busy night in Rapids, with Brothers Burn Mountain coming to Clocko Brewing at 7 p.m. The eclectic duo from Cotton, Minnesota recently released a best-of album to celebrate their 25-year anniversary. Their live show features a drum-heavy mix of psychedelic blues, rock, and folk music, Friday at 7 p.m. Finally, Dave Simonette is playing at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids, Saturday at 7. The Trampled by Turtles frontman is returning after a sold-out Dead Man Winter show in early 2024. Since then, he released 5 new original songs recorded by both Trampled and Dead Man Winter, and collaborated with Alan Sparhawk of Low. It is Dave Simonette this Saturday at the Rife Center in Grand Rapids. The set list is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
It is 529, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE-KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. Check KAXE.org for more information about food-related resources across northern Minnesota, with hours of operation and locations of food shelves, along with information on soup kitchens and community meals. Add resources in your region by emailing news at KAXE.org.
Involves the risk of loss.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Wicked for Good has finally got Hollywood feeling good after several slack months at the box office. But can it cast its spell over the rest of the holiday season as well? Critic Bob Bondello says there are reasons for optimism. He's here with his end-of-year movie preview.
If Green and Pink Witches can attract a few million moviegoers, what might a whole planet's worth of blue Na'vi do?
This world goes much deeper than you imagine.
James Cameron's epic Avatar introduced audiences to Pandora's forest-dwelling Na'vi. Avatar Way of Water brought contact with a coastal tribe. Now in Avatar Fire and Ash, we'll meet the literally volcanic mountain Na'vi.
Protect your sisters.
Yes, sir. Stay undercover.
The Ash people are aggrieved, aggressive, and unlike the tribes in Pandora's low-lying regions, willing to embrace technology, which gives an old human foe an in.
You want to spread your fire across the world. You need me.
Avatar Fire and Ash will almost certainly dominate the holidays, but it won't be alone at Cineplexes. In addition to the Zootopia and Knives Out sequels already in theaters, Quentin Tarantino is releasing a combo attraction he conceived 2 decades ago.
Any more details?
Kill Bill: The Whole Bloody Affair combines both volumes of Tarantino's martial arts revenge opus with some additional footage.
And we're talking the whole shebang.
In a 4-hour and 41-minute splatterfest, including an intermission.
I am gonna kill Bill.
There will be less demanding sits out there, including a pair of starry semi-biopics. Marty Supreme features Timothy Chalamet as a fictionalized version of Marty Reisman.
Hey, it's Marty Mauser.
Who was a table tennis champ in the 1950s. Like the real guy, he's a hugely talented player and also a bit of a hustler.
I know it's hard to believe, but I'm telling you, this game, it fills stadiums overseas. And it's only a matter of time before I'm staring at you from the cover of a Wheaties box.
Meanwhile, in Song Sung Blue, Hugh Jackman will also be channeling a striving showbiz type, but not the one who made this song famous, one who came later.
What do you think?
You don't want to be a Neil Diamond impersonator. You want to be a Neil Diamond interpreter.
I was looking for the right way to say it, and you just came right out and said it.
Kate Hudson's a Patsy Cline interpreter, by that measure. Other films about performers include Is This Thing On?, starring Will Arnett as a guy who starts doing comedy about his failing marriage to avoid a $15 cover charge on open mic night.
I think I'm getting a divorce.
He's not very funny at first.
What tipped me off was that I'm living in an apartment on my own. Yeah, and my wife and kids don't live there. That was probably the biggest clue.
Laura Dern plays his wife, and director Bradley Cooper also stars, though he plays third fiddle to them and their family members.
You tell jokes?
Well, I try. It's more like kind of funny stories from my life. And
oh, honey, what? I had no idea your life was this bad.
Now, what's funny about your life?
This is why she threw you out!
Amateur performers of an earlier era populate The Choral, about a provincial British town's attempt to hold its choral group together as its members head off to fight in World War I.
I feel it's my patriotic duty.
We'll need a new chorus master.
I hope he puts the wind up the Germans more than he ever did the Sopranos.
Alan Bennett, who wrote The Lady in the Van and The Madness of King George, penned that line, and he's conceived The Choral as a vehicle for their new concert master, played by Ralph Fiennes.
He's been working in Germany.
Treachery.
He's an atheist.
There are atheists now. There's one in Bradford.
We veered into comedy here, and this holiday season, comedies come in some specifically cinematic flavors. There's Fackham Hall, a spoof that mixes up Downton Abbey.
Finally, one of our children is to be wed. She's 23, a dried-up husk of a woman.
I'm just delighted she's finally found the right cousin.
And Agatha Christie mysteries.
This is Inspector Watt.
Well, I don't know. Inspector Phillips?
No. His surname is Watt.
I see. What is his name?
Robert.
Robert Watt.
Exactly.
And what Facum Hall does for costume dramas, Jack Black and Paul Rudd will be doing for a certain style of action horror.
Let's do it. Let's reboot Anaconda.
Yes.
Wait.
What?
Just some guys in mid-life crisis.
We need a riverboat, a script, a snake handler, and a real snake.
Except the snake dies.
And we no longer have a snake for our snake movie. We have to go out in the jungle and find another one.
What could possibly go wrong? And there's a satire about a different kind of play acting.
Welcome to Atropia. A 24-7 warfare simulation. A town populated with civilian role players. And movie special effects designed to give our brave men and women the tools to fight and win.
Oh,
yeah,
I'm
dead.
Atropia won a top prize at this year's Sundance Film Festival. Also a favorite on the festival circuit, Park Chan-wook's social satire, No Other Choice, about a fired factory manager whose job hunting plan includes eliminating his competition. Jim Jarmusch cocks a jaundiced eye at domestic life in Father, Mother, Sister, Brother.
What do you say we toast our tea to family relations?
Oh.
You've always been my favorite son.
Well, you're only son.
As far as we know.
Can you toast with tea, though?
Really?
Also looking at family relationships, writer-director James L. Brooks, a co-creator of The Simpsons. Ella McKay is his first comedy in more than a decade.
You just became governor of the state you were born and raised in.
Sex Education's Emma Mackey is the title character whose election does not exempt her from family challenges.
Your father's here.
Why?
We haven't seen each other. How long? You don't know either?
Eddie, you promised not to be yourself.
And of course, at some point during the holidays, the kids will get the itch to grab some popcorn. Ready to scratch that itch is the SpongeBob movie, Search for SquarePants.
Dutchman's taken SpongeBob to the deepest, most dangerous part of the sea.
The underworld.
Ah! Underwear? Underwear.
Enough with the jokes. You want something more substantial? Well, how about the Old Testament tale of David and Goliath?
David! You have stolen the hearts of my people!
I have never wanted the throne.
Lies!
Aiming at family audiences, Angel Studios has animated and musicalized the biblical tale, calling it simply David. For more mature viewers, the creative couple behind last year's epic architect drama, The Brutalist, is taking on the story of a religious community, the Shakers, and the woman who founded that early 18th century movement in The Testament of Anne Lee.
We have made tremendous sacrifices to receive the greatest love that one can experience.
Music plays a central role in the film's storytelling, and the holiday season also brings a full-fledged musical straight from Broadway, Stephen Sondheim's decade-spanning Show That Goes Backwards.
Merrily we roll along, roll along.
It was a standing-room-only smash last year with a cast that included Hamilton's King George, Jonathan Groff, and Filmdom's Harry Potter, Daniel Radcliffe.
I think Charlie and I will handle success very well.
Look how well we've handled failure.
That stage version, where an orchestra seat could cost up to $900, was filmed in front of a live audience, and now you can see that same Merrily We Roll Along for the price of a movie ticket. One of many reasons to head with old friends to a Cineplex over the holidays. I'm Bob Mandela.
Here's to us, who's like us, damn few.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 529, and you're tuned in to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Coming up next is the Up North Report. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library continue their Brown Bag Author Series Monday, December 1st at noon with Minnesota author Will Weaver. He will talk about his new book, Black Dirt, Bright Stars, a sequel to Power and Light. Now it's time for the Up North Report from our KAXE KBXE news team.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report.
A 69-year-old man died in a weather-related accident Wednesday morning in St. Louis County. Brian Pellender of Alden Township, west of Two Harbors, went outside to blow snow. His wife found him 45 minutes later underneath a large fallen tree. The St. Louis County Sheriff's Office says the high winds and wet, heavy snow downed the tree while Pellender was snow-blowing near it, fatally injuring him. A Grand Rapids woman facing a criminal vehicular homicide charge pleaded not guilty Wednesday morning in Itasca County District Court. 65-year-old Cynthia Cindy Martin hit and killed 19-year-old Carter Hathcock near Nashwalk before driving away the night of July 3, 2024. The plea is the latest in a year of legal moves in the case. Martin was first charged last November. Her defense has attempted to have the case dismissed, to suppress evidence, or move to another venue, all of which were denied by Judge Heidi Chandler. The next step is a pretrial settlement conference set for February 23rd. County Attorney Jacob Fotchold says there isn't a plea offer beyond Martin admitting guilt as charged.
Under those circumstances, it's not unusual for defendants to roll the dice, so to speak, and go to trial, knowing that the outcome that they would face at trial is similar to what we're offering for resolution.
Fotchold says there may be more legal maneuvering before the trial, such as Martin's defense again attempting to get the trial moved. The case has been under scrutiny from some members of the public because of Martin's prominent role in the DFL party. But Fotchold says the idea of politics influencing the case is, quote, absurd, and the case is moving at the same pace as any other under similar circumstances. Martin's defense did not return a request for comment by deadline. The nonprofit Kids Count on Us Bemidji is inviting the community to join elected leaders at a forum centered on affordability. The event will feature stories from community members who will share their experiences with the affordability of health care and child care. Elected officials and community leaders are expected to attend. The forum is 6 to 7:30 p.m. Wednesday at Beltrami Electric Cooperative. Those interested are asked to register in advance. MnDOT is sharing its plans for the Highway 73 corridor in Chisholm. The agency has been studying the one-mile stretch from Highway 169 to the intersection of West Lake Street and 3rd Avenue. It will share its findings and present a proposed final layout at a meeting Wednesday. The meeting is 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Chisholm Senior Citizens Building. Essentia Health Fostin is hosting its 21st annual tree walk for hospice on Sunday. Attendees can stroll through decorated Christmas trees created by local organizations and community members and bid on their favorite tree through a silent auction. Crystal angel ornaments will also be available for purchase in honor or memory of a loved one. Funds raised from the event will support specialized care for patients and families served through hospice. The Fostin Langby Lions Club will serve a free will donation breakfast from 10 a.m. to noon, and a remembrance program with a candle lighting ceremony starts at 12:15. Finding a mental health provider in rural areas is hard, but Minnesota researchers say it's much harder for communities of color in small towns. A new report lays out specific obstacles to care and solutions that show hope. The Center for Rural Policy and Development's latest report says lack of insurance, stigma, and trust issues are factors that complicate the issue. No matter the solution, Vice President of Research Marnie Werner says minority populations in small towns need to have agency in making mental health care culturally appropriate.
When a group looks at something that the larger population is saying, here, do this, and they're like, why? I don't understand this, or this doesn't fit with my culture or my understanding of the world or anything. I think that's the big thing, is to give groups the tools and then get out of the way.
For example, the report points to the Red Lake Nation reinventing their social services department using their own words, values, and beliefs. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for this story. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is made possible by Woodland Bank, providing customers with personal and business banking solutions, as well as offering Kasasa checking accounts. You can learn more online at woodland.bank.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from the Wallace Foundation, an independent nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, at wtgrantfdn.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow. Pope Leo XIV has started the first foreign trip of his papacy, traveling to the Middle East. Today in Turkey, he appealed for tolerance between different peoples and religions. He called for harmony and unity in the world and said that in these polarized times, the very future of humanity was at stake. NPR's Ruth Sherlock is traveling on the plane with the first American pope and takes us through the first day of Leo's trip.
A little after we took off from Rome, Pope Leo XIV came to the back of the plane to greet us, the journalists on board.
Buongiorno a tutti. To the Americans here, happy Thanksgiving. It's a wonderful day to celebrate.
Meeting over 80 journalists from at least 15 different countries who are watching your every expression and word might seem daunting. But Leo, who was chosen for the papacy in May this year, seemed to take it in his stride. He greeted each journalist one by one.
It's a pleasure to meet you, Holy Father. I'm Ruth Sherlock from NPR. I hope you have a good Thanksgiving.
Thank you.
He smiled warmly and said little, though he did reveal that he'd managed to complete the New York Times Wordle puzzle in three tries before boarding the plane early this morning. Some journalists gave him gifts, including, on this Thanksgiving Day, at least two pumpkin pies. In Ankara, we arrive at the vast presidential palace complex, its walls painted in gold and sage, and with rows of guards in white hats and turquoise long coats marching outside. The Pope is greeted in style, his car accompanied by a Turkish cavalry, riders on delicate purebred horses trotting in perfect unison. A marching band plays as Pope Leo and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan walk side by side into the palace. For all the ceremony, the matters to be discussed here are substantial. President Erdogan has a complex relationship with Christians in this Muslim-majority country. For example, in 2020, Erdogan turned the Hagia Sophia heritage site, important for Christians and Muslims, into a mosque.
Katolik dünyasının ruhani lideri.
In speeches at a grand library after their private discussion, Erdogan offered warm words for Pope Leo, praising his outspoken stance against civilian suffering in Gaza in Israel's more than two-year-long offensive there. Pope Leo praised Turkey's rich history, culture, and landscape.
The natural beauty of your country urges us to protect God's creation.
But he also had quite a direct message for Turkey's leader, who's promoted Sunni Muslim identity as central to the modern Turkish national identity. Protect your minorities, Leo urged.
A society is alive if it has a plurality. For what makes it a civil society are the bridges that link its people together.
Across the world, Pope Leo said, human communities are increasingly polarized and torn apart by extreme positions that fragment them. The Pope hopes this trip, with the warm welcome laid on by President Erdogan with marching bands and this singing group, is one way to again call for peace and unity.
God is good all the time.
Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, Ankara.
Affordability has become a key issue heading into the midterm elections next year. Some of those consequential midterm races are happening in the swing state of Wisconsin. That's where Mayan Silver from member station WUWM talked to voters ahead of the Thanksgiving holiday.
Inside the Victory Garden Initiative, a Milwaukee organization that fights food insecurity, people are getting served scoops of mac and cheese, greens, cornbread.
Would you like some gravy?
And of course, turkey.
That enough?
Yeah, that'll be enough.
Okay, enjoy.
Thanks.
Outside, the line for free turkeys and Thanksgiving-style meals is bending around the corner.
Hi, would you guys like to talk or?
Cheryl Britton is in line, keeping balance with her cane. She's 57, born and raised in Milwaukee, and currently living in her van. She's having a hard time affording food.
Everything in the store, it's like, so I used to get this meat. Now I can't get this meat. You know what I mean? I like this part of the chicken. No, now I gotta get probably thighs or whatever. I like the breast, but I can't afford the breast.
To her, local help like this seems very far away from what's happening in Washington, D.C.
The Trump administration, Democrat, Republican, liberal, white wing, left wing, back wing, horizontal wing, I don't give a freak. Get your stuff together, period.
She used to be a reliably Democratic voter. Now, she says, both parties are catering to the 1%. Like some others in line, she didn't vote in 2024.
And I would not be voting until they try to at least attempt to go back to for the people.
A few feet back in line, Calvin Jones is sitting on his rollator. He's a 67-year-old veteran who squarely blames Trump for today's economy, pinning blame on him for the shutdown, changes to federal food assistance and health costs, and the federal minimum wage.
For an ability does not exist. There's no way a person to make $7.25 an hour can afford to rent an apartment that's $12, $13, $14, $1,500. It's not possible, unless you got 20 people living in the apartment.
Halfway through the three-hour event, demand was so great, organizers ran out of free turkeys. About 10 miles away, people are gathering at an international folk fair. Aaron Eckhart, president of a home building company, is there with his kids. As for the cost of living,
it's definitely up right now. So things are a little tighter than you like them to be sometimes.
He's a Republican who voted for Trump and thinks the economy is headed in a good direction.
Well, it's wasn't in good shape, but I feel like it could be turning around right now.
He likes President Trump's idea of passing along some of the revenue from tariffs to Americans with $2,000 rebates. So far, Trump hasn't offered a lot of details on the proposal, but that doesn't dissuade Eckhart.
So I think it's turning around.
So you think that President Trump is delivering on the promises that he made to make life more affordable?
Correct. Promises made, promises kept.
Keith Songstead was also headed into the fair to see his wife's Italian dance group. He's an accountant from a suburb outside of Milwaukee, an independent who typically votes conservative and voted for Trump in 2024. Does he think Trump is keeping up with his promise to make things more affordable?
Yes, I think he's working on it. You know, I think it's only been less than a year, so I think there's work to be done, but certainly.
And what do you think Trump needs to do going forward?
I think he needs to concentrate on America. You know, that's the whole idea. Let's worry less about globalization. Let's worry more about what's going on here.
He's happy to enjoy an event celebrating world cultures, but economically, it's America first. For NPR News, I'm Ayan Silver in Milwaukee.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. Consider the turkey. The bird is it's often the staple of the Thanksgiving table. You might be eating one this very moment. But how exactly did the turkey take center stage? In this installment of our Word of the Week, our series looking at the origins of popular words, NPR's Natalie Escobar digs into the history of turkey.
We talk turkey. We quit cold turkey. We even turkey lurkey. These birds are icons, and deservedly so. Here's turkey farmer Jesse Strait from Miffletree Farms in Warrenton, Virginia.
They're so friendly. They're a lot like dogs. You know, they're curious. They want to check you out. They want to come and see what you're doing.
But for all of its cultural dominance, much of the turkey's history is shrouded in uncertainty. Linguists say that's particularly true for how it got its name.
Turkey is a very confusing
confusing name.
That's Anatoly Lieberman, an entomologist from the University of Minnesota, Twin Cities. Now, there's some general consensus about the turkey's history, he says. It was domesticated in the Americas and then brought to Europe by Spanish colonists around the 1520s.
The bird is an importation. It is from the New World.
But in Europe, the bird became the victim of mistaken identity. The African guinea fowl, which had been brought to the continent by merchants around a century earlier, was often referred to as a turkey. And because the birds generally looked alike and were often prepared the same way, people also started calling the American bird a turkey. Here is lexicographer Erin McKean.
I bet they look a lot more similar when they're like denuded of their feathers, roasted and on a plate.
So why was the guinea fowl known as a turkey? McKean explains.
And it was likely taken into Europe, you know, through what used to be called the Levant, right? So Turkey area.
But Lieberman says it's probably just a historical fluke that Europeans started calling it that.
They were not sure where the bird came from and ascribed its origin to all kinds of foreign lands.
Over the next century, the English grew particularly fond of turkeys, including at Christmas dinner. So when English settlers headed across the Atlantic to what's now North America, they brought the birds with them and eventually included them at Thanksgiving dinners. Even though the turkey's origin story is pretty murky, it turns out it's in good company, Lieberman says.
If you look at the origin of bird names, most of them are mysterious, very hard to etymologize.
So if the name is kind of a misnomer, why is it stuck around? McKean has a theory.
One I think we can't lose sight of is that turkey is pretty much a fun word to say.
I'm inclined to agree. For NPR News, I'm Natalie Escobar.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
It is 5:48, and you're listening to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE. I'm Andrew DeZingle. Support for KAXE comes from Grand Itasca Clinic and Hospital, home to an experienced OBGYN team that provides comprehensive women's health services, including maternity and advanced gynecology care, all in Grand Rapids. Learn more at granditasca.org. The 44th Annual City of Lights event is in downtown Nisswa tomorrow. The celebration includes food vendors, the Polar Express storytelling, Santa's petting zoo, bonfires, train rides, carolers, and fireworks. United Way of 1000 Lakes is currently collecting cleaning and personal hygiene items for their Home for Good drive, now through December 12th. There are several drop-off sites in Grand Rapids and Deer River, including Essentia Health and Northern Star Senex. Find more info at uwlakes.org. Downtown Walker invites you to a Festival of Lights Friday, November 28th with a parade at 5 p.m. and a tree lighting at 6. Activities continue Saturday, November 29th, including a kids' open house at Walker Bay Theater from 11 to 3. You can cut your own Christmas tree in the Superior or Chippewa National Forests. Permits are now available at recreation.gov. You may also stop by a district office to get a permit. If you or someone you know is living with Parkinson's disease, there is a support group Tuesday, December 2nd at 1 p.m. in the meeting room at Central Square Mall in Grand Rapids. The group meets the first Tuesday of every month. The Clearwater County Historical Society hosts the Festival of Trees beginning Tuesday, December 2nd. Enjoy more than 30 trees and vote for your favorite. Donations of non-perishable food items are encouraged. Special events are happening each weekend through December 21st. Now we'll take you back to All Things Considered here on KAXE KBXE.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ailsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Every week, a guest draws a card from NPR's wildcard deck and answers a big question about their life. Suleika Jawad has lived with cancer since her early 20s. Her latest project, The Book of Alchemy, is a guide to journaling, which helped her through her illness. Jawad talked to wildcard host Rachel Martin about the community of friends that also helped her.
When do you feel connected to the people you've lost?
This is such a good one. You know, I've lost a lot of people. I had the great joy and privilege when I was 22 and I was sick of befriending some fellow patients. I was desperate for friends who understood what I was going through. And as someone who is often decades younger than the other adult cancer patients, anytime I saw someone under the age of 30 at the hospital, I would pounce on them and be like, can we please hang out? And what that yielded was this incredible friend group. My friend Max Ritvo, who was a brilliant poet. My friend Melissa Carroll, who's an incredible artist. And most of my friends died by the end of my 20s. I think two out of those 10 friends are alive now. And so I went through a lot of loss at a young age. And I think when you experience that kind of deep loss, there's a way in which it can make you want to guard your heart because to open yourself up to new love is inevitably to also open yourself up to new loss. And the truth is, you know, I would experience any amount of grief to experience those loves.
You know, I wonder, how is it to be the person who got to live longer? Was that a struggle to be the person who survived?
I think at every major milestone in my life, I feel that kind of bittersweet twinge of, you know, getting married. In the back of my mind, I'm thinking to myself, oh, this person will never get married. With every birthday as I get older, it's that sense of moving further away from the shared slice of life that you had together, while also, you know, feeling that they're with you. And, you know, one thing I loved about Melissa and Max in particular, and I believe this to be true of myself, which is that my illness is the least interesting thing about me. What I admired about them was not the mere fact that they were sick. Lots of people get sick. It's how they responded to their illness. And so Max, in the last months of his life, published his first poem in The New Yorker and wrote two books. Melissa, she started making these haunting, beautiful self-portraits in watercolor. And so each of them, I think, are people I look to as I navigate these new challenges now about how I can be the handler of my fears rather than the handled.
You can watch a longer conversation with Suleika Jawad by following at NPR Wildcard on YouTube. The Book of Alchemy is out now.
Support for Wildcard with Rachel Martin comes from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
So the first Stranger Things season came out in 2016. 9 years later, the show is ending. The first batch of episodes in that final season dropped last night on Netflix, and critic Eric Deggans is all caught up. He's here with us now to talk about the show that became a phenomenon for Netflix. And a slight warning, we will be talking about details from the new episodes. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Ailsa.
Okay, so it's been 3 years, right, since we last saw new episodes on this show. Can you just remind us, where the crew in Hawkins, Indiana, last left off.
Sure. So as always, Stranger Things is focused on this group of young people in the 1980s, and they're working with a few trusted adults in the fictional town of Hawkins to combat this super-powered villain in an alternate universe called the Upside Down. Uh-huh. Now, last season, we saw the Upside Down intrude into the real world following efforts by this psychically powered bad guy called Vecna. And this season, the military's quarantined Hawkins. They're regularly testing residents, and they're guarding this portal between the worlds, which pulses and throbs like some gooey outtake from an alien movie or something.
I like that line.
you gotta love it. So a little while ago, Netflix released the first 5 minutes of the first episode of this new season. So some fans already know the new episodes start with this horrific flashback, and lots of what happens in the final episodes are going to reframe and reference stuff that happened in previous seasons.
Okay, so without giving us any spoilers, what was your reaction when you saw several of these new episodes?
You know, I think some of this is going to feel very familiar to fans. I mean, Noah Schnapp's character, Will Byers, has this mysterious connection to Vecna and the Upside Down. Millie Bobby Brown's character, this psychically powered girl named Eleven, is in hiding in Hawkins, training to prepare for a showdown with Vecna. And the other characters are trying to figure out how to find Vecna in the Upside Down so they can hopefully stop this threat that he poses to their world. Now, in the middle of all of this, we get the series' trademark sprinkles of 80s pop culture. But even though a lot of this is going to feel familiar to Stranger Things fans, I think the series creators and showrunners Matt and Ross Duffer, they're so skilled at keeping this plot hurtling along that a lot of people are not going to notice how much these new dangers feel like old storylines.
Well, it does feel like Stranger Things started a lifetime ago. I mean, for me, it certainly felt like that because I was living in a different city, doing a different job. What do you think has made this series so popular for so long?
Well, it pulled together a bunch of trends. I mean, it's a thrilling horror science fiction story. It's got this nostalgia for the 1980s, movie-level special effects, important experience for a generation of young viewers who grew up with the show, and they found these great, engaging young actors. And one of their biggest challenges is going to be making these actors who are growing into adults look younger than they really are.
That's for sure. The first Stranger Things season, I remember, it like came out all at once. And I noticed since then Netflix has gotten more strategic, I guess, and spaced things out. Can you just remind us when the rest of the episodes will be released?
Well, you know, you can sort of say Netflix has turned this final season into its holiday gift to the world, right? You know, you got four episodes released last night during Thanksgiving week, then three are coming on Christmas Day, and the series finale arrives on New Year's Eve when it will also be shown in select theaters. But whether this really feels like a holiday present might depend on how eager viewers are to dive into yet another adventure, hanging the world's fate on a bunch of teenagers from small town Indiana.
That is NPR's critic at large, Eric Deggans. Happy Thanksgiving, Eric.
Same to you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Focus Features presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal. Now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th. From Subaru, the Subaru Share the Love event runs through January 2nd. By year's end, Subaru and its retailers will have donated more than $350 million to charity. Subaru, more than a car company. From Bayer, Bayer is dedicated to delivering breakthroughs that save lives and feed the world using the scientific process. Learn more at sciencedelivers.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at wtgrantfdn.org.
You are listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids and 90.5 KBXE Bagley Bemidji. We are Northern Community Radio, telling the stories of the people and land of Northern Minnesota through music, news, conversation, and events. Operating translator K210DR in Brainerd at 89.9. Listen at KAXE.org or on your smart speaker. We need people like you to support this local media. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234. Thank you. We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years. not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com. Kotaska Community Action offers free lunch every Wednesday from 11 to 1 at their Circles of Support office, located across from Treasure Bay Printing on Northeast 4th Street in Grand Rapids. They also offer a food pantry from 11 to 2, Monday through Thursday.